Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. This past weekend was especially tough for many Philadelphia cops and residents. There were several multiple shootings, including one late Friday night in which a young man in his 20s went on a rampage in West Philadelphia, killing a 25-year-old woman and wounding five other people, including two police officers. Another officer was fired upon by a 19-year-old during a foot chase Saturday, and a number of times throughout the weekend, police responded to single shootings in which some of the victims succumbed to their injuries. The total number of dead from Friday through Sunday was five. 14 were wounded. And this comes as there's word that the murder rate in Philadelphia is on the rise, an increase of about 8% over this time last year. Philly is not alone. A number of cities, most notably Chicago, are noticing an increase in homicides. But across the country, the overall crime rate is at historically low levels. So this hour, we take an in-depth look at the story behind the numbers. What is your perception of crime? Is it seemingly everywhere or fairly rare? Here's the number if you'd like to weigh in, 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll begin the show by focusing on Philadelphia. Chris Palmer is a crime reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philadelphia Daily News, and Philly.com. Welcome to Radio Times, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So it was admittedly an unusually bloody 3 days in Philadelphia. And Chris, could you give us a deeper sense of what this weekend was like for communities and police?
The most chaotic incident started Friday night when a 25-year-old man named Nicholas Glenn allegedly walked up to a police car. There was a police sergeant sitting in a her car on patrol, and Nicholas Glenn pulled out his 9mm Ruger handgun and started firing 18 rounds into her car. The sergeant, Sylvia Young, managed to lay down. She was hit, and actually her service weapon was hit at one point, disabling her gun so she couldn't return fire. But miraculously, she managed to survive, and other officers came to her rescue and transported her to a hospital. In the meantime, though, Glenn continued his rampage, and he opened fire at a bar, striking two people at a bar about a block away. And then he allegedly shot at two people inside of a car, killing, as you mentioned, the 25-year-old woman. And then the night culminated with a shootout with police officers in an alley in West Philadelphia, where he struck a University of Pennsylvania police officer, a retired Philadelphia police officer, and where the officer shot Glenn and he was killed. It was a kind of a chaotic and crazy incident. Shootings in Philadelphia rarely kind of have these three separate shooting areas where a police officer's hit, patrons in a bar are hit, people in a car are hit, and then a shootout ends in a bloody toll with other police officers. It was a chaotic night for police over in West Philadelphia.
And a start to a chaotic weekend.
That's right.
So let's get into some of the whys. I was reading some of your articles. You say that interviews in recent days have yielded a variety of theories. One is the unpredictable nature of urban crime. Just a weekend or so back, there were no homicides in Philly.
That's right. The weekend before last, there were no homicides, which is particularly kind of unusual, especially in the summer when murder numbers tend to spike. And after a weekend when there were no murders, the Tuesday after that, there were, I think it was four or five, and there were more shootings than that. And what the police will tell you is that it's not just that the days and the times can be different. It's that the crime can be spread across different neighborhoods. And so where police can concentrate resources to prevent retaliatory shootings, it's really difficult to do that if you have shootings in North Philadelphia and West Philadelphia and South Philadelphia and Northeast Philadelphia, as we did on Tuesday. Again, sometimes police, they'll tell you, it's really hard to predict where the first shooting may occur. What they want to do is prevent retaliatory violence if someone comes back to get revenge. But if you have to try and concentrate your resources in different areas of the city, it's just – it's really difficult to do that.
It's hard to really try to look ahead to figure out where you need to put your officers. That's what you're saying.
Right. And because they can be spread across different neighborhoods of the city. It's not as if they're all concentrated in one area, you can flood that area. But if there's a broader the amount of space you have to cover, it's much tougher to concentrate those resources after a shooting to prevent the retaliation.
All right, let's get to another critical factor. You write that as the homicide rate is going up in the city, the rate at which these killings are solved is declining. I guess that's known as the clearance rate when a case is resolved.
That's right.
And unsolved cases can fuel additional violence. Could you get into that for us?
Yeah, I found this very interesting, and I'll admit that there's no data that I found to show that this is a fact, but it's certainly an interesting theory. So a few years ago, the Philadelphia homicide clearance rate, again, the rate at which there was an arrest in an open homicide case, was about at 70% or so, pretty consistently, between 65 or 70%. That rate has been going down over the past few years, and through July of this year, it stood at about 54%. It's easy to imagine how this could have an impact on certain communities where this violence can be concentrated. People may know, rumors travel more quickly on the street than they do through law enforcement. And so people in the community may know that there is someone on the other corner who committed a murder who is still out there. There's someone on the other corner who shot someone else and is still out there. That may embolden people who feel that they want to take a shot at someone else because they may know so-and-so on that corner, they weren't caught. So yeah. If I do it, I may not get caught. And it also, Philadelphia has a very tough time getting witnesses to testify. It can be even harder if they know that the people who are committing crimes, who are shooting and murdering other people, are still out there.
That was my next question. Do we know, in your work, have you found reasons as to why this clearance rate is going down?
So,
is it because of the intimidation factor?
I think it's undeniable that intimidation is a part of solving homicide cases. I think homicide investigators will tell you that about 2 years ago, there were new interrogation policies put in place, which they say has made making arrests harder. These include videotaping interrogations with suspects. It's harder to get witnesses from the scene into interview rooms. Once witnesses are in these interview rooms, the homicide investigators have to remind them, you can leave whenever you want. These are all policies that have to be undertaken now. The police commissioner says that he's not sold that those policies are the reason for the drop. Many of these policies, such as videotaping interrogations, I mean, those have been commonplace in other cities for a long time, and there's still ways to make arrests. But it's certainly something that homicide investigators, I think, grumble about from time to time when you ask them, why is it harder to solve a case now?
Well, what about witness intimidation on the street?
Yeah, I think, again, it's certainly – there's no way to say it's not a factor. Grand juries are often used in homicide cases at times to give witnesses the ability to provide information anonymously. And, you know, it's – again, in certain communities, if you know that there are people out there who are still on the street after they've committed a shooting or a murder, it can be intimidating to come forward, justifiably so. You could be worried about your safety, and it's intimidating to testify, I think, in any murder trial where your safety could be at risk, depending on what you say and what you tell the police.
So, Chris, you know, a few years ago, Charles Ramsey, who was the police commissioner at the time, was optimistic that the city could get to a place where there are fewer than 200 homicides a year. And, of course, it's gone the other way. What is your sense as to why, since last year through this year, there's an 8% increase?
It's tough to say. I mean, that's when I started out reporting this piece, I was trying to understand exactly that question. Like, why is it continuing to go up? And I think some of these things, they are theories that people have, that the lower clearance rate, people feeling that there may be impunity for crimes like this, and maybe that contributes to it. The fact that crime is random and it's harder for police to patrol different areas. The number of police officers that are on staff is about, the commissioner says, the current commissioner, Richard Ross, says is about 350 police below where he'd like to be. I think all of those things contribute. But one thing I think that's important for context as well, and I don't think anyone's justifying an 8% increase in homicide, but, you know, the expression I've used is we're really bouncing off a floor here. You know, the murder rate, the number of murders in 2013 was 246, which is as low as murder totals in Philadelphia had been for a long time. In the 1990s, there were routinely between 400 and 500 murders in Philadelphia. And so, again, I don't think anyone's advocating for any kind of increase in homicide.
Sure.
But it is important, I think, for context to realize that we are coming off historic lows over the past few decades in Philadelphia.
As a reporter, how do you feel about the so-called Ferguson effect in which, you know, officers hold back in some situations to avoid generating controversy and end up on a video that generates negative attention, and of course named after the city in Missouri in which 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed a few years back?
I think if you ask rank and file police officers, this is far and away the most common reason that they would give for why crime, homicides in particular, are going up. They would say, we don't want to be out there on a video. We don't want to put our necks out. You know, we'll respond to 911 calls. You know, if we get dispatched to a crime scene, you know, we'll do what we're supposed to do. But as far as taking proactive steps, it's just too risky. And we don't want to be sold out in the media. We don't want to be sold out in the press. We're just going to kind of respond to the calls that we get, and we're not going to be as proactive.
This is what you're hearing from Philadelphia police officers?
Far and away the most common, if you poll police officers and say, well, you know, why is the murder total up? This is the response you get back most frequently from rank and file officers. But I think that, you know, it's important to note that there are other trends in the crime rate that kind of undercut some of that logic. Gun arrests in Philadelphia, according to the police department, are actually up this year. Other violent crimes such as rape, robbery, assault, those numbers are down. That doesn't happen without police activity. I think I talked to a criminologist who said that there's obvious that something is happening. You ask police officers all over the country and they all give you the same response. I don't think you can discount the feelings of police officers when it's that uniform.
Yeah.
But we have to take into account that there's evidence to suggest that, you know, that it's not quite as widespread or having as much of an effect as maybe we think anecdotally.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit more as we continue with the show. Chris Palmer, I know you're covering this story from the police angle. Not sure you've been in the neighborhoods and might be hearing, you know, what residents are saying about this uptick in the number of homicides.
I talked to a couple of residents yesterday and people who work with community groups on the ground, and what I heard from them oftentimes is there are a lot of illegal guns out there. Nicholas Glenn, who we talked about 20 minutes or 10 minutes ago, the shots he was firing on police officers, on citizens, he was firing from a 9mm Ruger that had a wiped off serial number. There was a man in January who opened fire on another police officer who opened fire with a stolen police firearm that he didn't legally purchase. The proliferation of illegal guns, I think, is something that a lot of residents in these neighborhoods where I do get out to report quite a bit are concerned about.
Yeah. All right. We're taking a close look at the reasons why the homicide rate is up in a number of cities across the country, including Philadelphia. Chris Palmer is with us for a while longer on Radio Times. He's with Philly.com. We'll also be joined by John Roman after the break. John is an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania and Georgetown University. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. After years of decline, the homicide rate is up in Philadelphia and in a number of cities across the country. Shootings are on the rise as well in some of those areas. And here with us in studio for the next few minutes to shed some light, Chris Palmer, a crime reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com. And as always, if you'd like to jump into the conversation, 888-477-9499. Is the number, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're going to focus on Philly for a few minutes more, and then we're going to broaden the conversation to the entire country and the perception among some that crime is up, even as overall crime rates are at historic lows. So tell us what you think about that. But back to you, Chris. This week, there was a call in the Inquirer editorial page that the carnage, in quotation marks, as the op-ed put it, should be treated as acts of terrorism. You know, you have a shooting rampage, which leaves one woman dead, five hurt in West Philly, another officer shot in her car. You know, in the week, there are 10 people shot in one day. Terrorism, just, you know, taking your reporter's hat off for a moment, what is your opinion? Do you think it should be rebranded?
What I would say is this. Every year in Philadelphia, there are between 1,000 to 1,200 shooting victims a year. That's a lot of people getting hit by bullets. And even though some don't die, when they get hit, the old adage with a shooting is that a homicide is just a shooting with better aim. If you get hit by a gunshot, the difference between you living and dying is maybe it hits you in the right side of your chest instead of the left, or maybe you get scooped up by someone and taken into the emergency room. It's hard to imagine 1,000 people getting hit in violent crime and not being concerned about it. As far as the terrorism angle, I'll leave that to other experts to decide what the definition should be. Mm-hmm. But I think we should be seriously concerned about the fact that in a city like ours, you know, we're looking at something like 1,000 minimum people getting shot every year. That's a lot.
Yeah. Well, the editorial points out that, you know, routine gun violence in Philly and other cities is more deadly than any terrorist incident since 9/11, but gets much less attention. And I was wondering if there's a saturation factor, compassion fatigue at work here. You know, if you don't live inside the city in some of these areas, you know, you kind of breeze past the headlines with that sort of thing.
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer, because this is what I cover every day. And I wish I, you know, there was a way I could, if I knew which stories would generate, you know, the best response, we would try and write those every day. I mean, I think I would challenge people to say that you can't, if you live in Philadelphia or any major city where there's gun violence, you can't only care about it if it happens on your corner. You have to care about the city as a whole. Gun violence impacts everyone that lives in a city. We shouldn't be living in places where people get shot and we don't care. I think we all have to care about it, regardless of whether it's on our corner or not.
All right. Let's get to an email from Julia, who's in Wilmington. Julia asks, has Philadelphia – oh, actually, I think I lost the wording there for a second. There it goes. Has Philadelphia had handgun laws struck down in the last few years? I believe that both Washington, D.C. and Chicago have had handgun laws struck down, but I haven't heard reporting that looked at whether the rise in gun violence correlates with the loss of handgun laws. Not sure if that's in your wheelhouse, Chris. You want to take a crack at that?
It's not, but it sounds like a story I should look into.
There you go. All right. At this point, let's bring John Roman into the program with us. John is senior fellow at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago and an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania and Georgetown University. His research focuses on innovative crime and justice policies and also reform. And again, that number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 888-477-9499. John, you've been listening in on the conversation and just talking a little bit about whether the carnage, as this op-ed put it, should be treated as acts of terrorism, if we need to change the way we view this story in the United States.
So I think that point, and good morning, thanks for having me.
Sure.
And I think that point is one that's well taken, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with the principle that all shootings, all homicides, all gun violence, which is what it mainly is, should be labeled an act of terrorism. It highlights that there are two things going on here, and they need to be deconstructed a little bit. One is to say, look, America is safer than it's been since the late 60s, 1970. If you're of my generation, you've never lived in a safer country than you do today. That said, the level of violence and carnage is unprecedented compared to other developed countries. And we want to think about, why is it that we feel comfortable living in a society that allows for this level of violence? And it's not just in our cities. It's all over the country. That, to me, is a separate conversation from the conversation that we're having today, which is, okay, we've experienced this generation-long decline in the level of violence in America beginning about 1991. And now we seem to be seeing an uptick in many cities in Philadelphia and in many cities across the country. And what has changed in the last year or two that has caused violence to start to go back up again? And I think you can answer those questions separately, but you have to understand that all this happens within this context of immense violence within within the U.S.
Well, Chris and I were talking a few moments ago about the Ferguson effect, and you know, we should bring into the conversation here news that's happened overnight in Charlotte. You had a 43-year-old, actually yesterday afternoon, African American man, Keith Scott, who was shot by a police officer, I believe, who was also African-American. But apparently the officers were trying to serve an arrest warrant on someone else. Scott was shot, allegedly because he had a gun. His family said, no, he didn't. Investors say they recovered a weapon. So that's still playing out. But you had a lot of unrest in Charlotte, and you had a lot of people, including police officers and residents, protesters, injured. So there's an open wound in this country.
Oh, there absolutely is. And I think it's important to discuss both sides of this perspective. I think people tend to adopt one and they ignore the other one. So one perspective is the law enforcement perspective. And they say, how are officers supposed to do their jobs in an environment where everybody has a cell phone, everybody is videotaping them? If they make a misstep, it's going to damage their career, maybe their family, maybe their life and livelihood and their freedom. On the other hand, you have residents of these communities that we're talking about for two and three generations have been stuck in intractably violent neighborhoods, and they are fed up and aren't interested in continuing the status quo. And there's lots going on beneath the surface, and I think the we can maybe talk about this later, but the Department of Justice report about Ferguson highlights a ton of police practices that contribute to these feelings that the police aren't legitimate authorities in a lot of these communities.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Chris, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Police Commissioner Richard Ross. He as far as the homicide rate in Philadelphia is concerned, he's quoted as saying it's one of the things that keeps you up at night. Tell us what you know of what the department under Richard Ross has been doing to try to reduce the number of homicides.
Police Commissioner Richard Ross started at the beginning of the year. He is a former homicide commander, so he is well-versed in a lot of the issues that the homicide department is facing. I mean, I think what the commissioner would tell you is that the thing that the police department can be really good at is, again, preventing retaliatory violence. It is often very difficult to know which corner someone will be on when they decide to pull the trigger on a gun. But police can be good at responding to those neighborhoods to try and prevent the person who was shot or friends of the person who was shot from shooting back at another group. I think that's where police focus a lot of their efforts. And they also try and focus on, I mean, they're a very statistic-oriented department, as many are now. They use a system called CompStat, where you try and deploy people based off of times that shootings occur, times that homicides occur, locations that they occur. Many districts have what are often dubbed gun grids, where there are concentrated areas where people are supposed to be patrolling during their shift, so that they can check in on. And those grids are determined often by statistics on where crime occurs and what times and whatnot. So I think they're very cognizant of trying to use data to inform their policing on the front end so that they know where people can be deployed, and then responding to incidents to try and prevent retaliatory violence on the back end. I think those are two things that they take a lot of pride in.
And one more quick question for you. How about efforts to improve relations with the communities they serve?
Yeah, that's something that the commissioner talks about quite a bit. And we saw, I think one of the highlights they would point to is during the Democratic National Convention, we had thousands of protesters here for an event that was very high profile, could have gotten very volatile. And police took a very different approach. They issued a lot of citations instead of arrests. They almost went out of their way to not arrest people. Mm-hmm. They would cite them and allow them to go. And they walked with them during protests. And this is an approach we've seen not just for the DNC, but for protests related to violence in Ferguson and protests in Ferguson and Baltimore and other cities. We've had protests in Center City where police have marched with these protesters. They have helped keep them out of harm's way, and they have, again, almost in some instances, gone out of their way not to bend over backwards and not to arrest people. And I think those are some efforts they would point to as ways that they're working with the community rather than just policing them.
All right. Chris Palmer, thank you so much. It was great to have you along here for Radio Times.
Thank you. It was fun.
Chris is a crime reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com. And now we'll bring into the conversation Ames Graward, counsel with the Brennan Center's Justice Program and lead author of a report called Crime in 2016, a Preliminary Analysis. Ames, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. We also have John Roman with us here. John, of course, is an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania and Georgetown University and senior fellow at the National Opinion Research Center. And so, Ames, first to you, give us a brief overview of what the analysis found.
Absolutely. So we looked at crime in the 30 largest cities insofar as we could get data from them. And found that while, as Mr. Roman has pointed out, while this is still a safer country than it has been in nearly a generation, there has been an increase in murders in some cities, and that increase is especially concentrated in a few cities, and especially Chicago. So we've used this as a way to indicate caution before worrying about murder as a national issue, but as an issue for real concern for some of these communities, such as Chicago.
Yeah. Why is Chicago suffering? Thoughts, John Roman?
Oh, absolutely. So Chicago has been a focal point for crime and justice research, both among the academic and research community and the federal government for decades now. And one of the reasons why it tends to be a place that experiences above average rates of violence is that it is one of the most racially and economically segregated cities in the United States. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you talk about crime and violence, you're talking about dense clusters of young men with few opportunities. And Chicago has sort of cornered the market on creating that environment. And it's not surprising that we see these continued trends of greater violence than average.
Let's get back to the so-called Ferguson effect. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel told Attorney General Loretta Lynch earlier this year that officers are going fetal. They don't want to be a news story themselves. They don't want their career ended early, and it's having an impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Ferguson effect has some credence. I think the idea that maybe an officer is a little less likely to proactively engage with the community is probably true, although the statistics that Chris cited for Philadelphia suggest that it's maybe not that big a factor. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody does a call for service and says, hey, I think my neighbor has an illegal weapon in their car. The police have to be policing to detect that. And the fact that gun arrests and gun seizures are up in Philadelphia suggests that the police are still working very hard to protect their communities.
Ames, even as the federal government in recent years has talked about the declining overall crime rate, as your report shows, the public sees it differently. A Gallup poll earlier this year found that over half of those surveyed were concerned a great deal about crime and violence, which is the highest level of concern in 15 years. Ames, how do you read that?
Sure. First, I wanted to add one point to your discussion about the Ferguson effect.
Absolutely.
I think there are a couple different versions of the Ferguson effect if you read some of the literature. There's the version that says police are pulling back from active patrol. That's, of course, most closely associated with Heather McDonald. There's another version of it that Richard Rosenfeld has described in a study he did on crime recently. And he says that his version of the Ferguson effect says that when there's a breakdown in police-community relations, that just makes it harder for police to do their jobs because police depend on communities to help them solve crimes. I think that's there's more data, there's more information to back up that version, and moreover, I think you'll find more police officers who are worried about that and integrating community policing into their programs. As to public perceptions of crime, I think it's just very easy to turn on the TV and see something like the events in Charlotte make a leap from that to saying, well, it seems like crime is going up nationwide. I think there's actually been some interesting research on if you ask people whether they think their community is safer, they'll say yes, but then they'll say they think the country as a whole has gotten more dangerous.
Okay.
It's almost like you can't see the forest for the trees. So people are reacting to something very real they see on the news. but it might be harder to translate that perception into a good perception of what's happening across the country.
We're going to hold that thought, Ames, because we're going to tackle that a little bit more in depth after the break. John Roman, I just wanted to follow up on something that Ames had said a moment or so ago, and that was the work that Richard Rosenfeld did, the criminologist in St. Louis. Yeah. What is your reaction to the question about the Ferguson effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think both perspectives have a little bit of merit. And I think, you know, Rick Rosenfeld's obviously a really important scholar on this question. And I think his point, and I think you're seeing it on the news right at the moment, that communities are really responding to what they see as a perceived threat to their liberties from law enforcement, which is new. And I think that the idea that the police don't want to engage is also probably true. I think there are other explanations for why crime has increased that are more important.
Right. And worth noting, too, Attorney General Loretta Lynch has said there's not enough data to support anecdotes of what's called depolicing. All right, let's get a comment or so in before we get to that break. Maureen says, I was pretty surprised to see how gang violence relates to violent crimes nationally. Ames, is that something that you tackled in your analysis?
This is actually one of the most interesting findings, I think, in our study. So as soon as we ran the numbers, Chicago leaped off the page as the place where murder was increasing most dramatically this year. So we did put a little time into figuring out why. And if you listen to what Chicago police are saying, they're saying that a disproportionate number of the people involved in gun crimes on either end of the weapon are people they know about, and they know about as repeat firearm offenders. And repeat firearm offenders, they found, are also fairly closely correlated with gangs. That does suggest to me that part of what we're seeing in Chicago could be an uptick in gang violence. And what's even more remarkable is what an effect that's having on the national numbers and the overall sample that we studied.
John, we've got about 20 seconds before we have to go to the break.
So we can follow up on this, but I think Chicago is a special story. It is an outlier, as Brennan reports. But I do think you have to ask the question, has something structurally changed in the way gangs operate in the last 2 years? And I actually don't see that.
All right. John Roman is senior fellow at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Ames Groward is a counsel with the Brennan Center's Justice Program. And if you'd like to get in on this conversation, we do have calls and comments coming in. 888-477-9499 or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. More in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're joined this hour by John Roman, a senior fellow at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. And Ames Groward is a counsel with the Brennan Center's Justice Program and lead author of a report called Crime in 2016, a Preliminary Analysis. And back to the overall crime rate, Ames, tell us a little bit more. Break out the figures, if you would, a little bit, because, again, overall crime is at historic lows in this country.
That's right. So when we talk about crime rates in our reports, we're looking at the six crimes most commonly studied by the FBI, and that includes property crimes and violent crimes. And what we're seeing is a continuing decrease in property crimes that's keeping the overall crime rate low. At the same time, we've seen an uptick in some violent crimes, and especially murder in some of the cities we studied. I think it's interesting that we're seeing different types of crimes change so differently. If you were to speak about a crime pandemic across the country, I think you would expect to see these all change together. And instead, we're seeing that all crime is local almost, but there might be different trends motivating different crimes to become more common in some cities rather than others.
And interestingly, too, with some of the cities in which you're expecting to see an increase, in which we have seen an increase in the violent crime rate, you're also expecting that rate to go down in a couple cities. What is it? Is it D.C. and in Baltimore?
Yes, this was another one of the big surprises for me. So in our report last year, we saw that half of the murder increase in the cities we studied was tied to Baltimore, Chicago, and D.C. I frankly expected that trend to continue. So when we did the initial analysis and saw that actually murders in Baltimore and D.C. are projected to go down this year, in a sense, it's heartening because these aren't cities where crime is continuing to go up. It's either leveling off or falling. and hopefully to return to pre-2015 levels. And I think that's an interesting commentary on how much crime rates can change between a given set of years.
Does Philadelphia enter the conversation anywhere here?
Thankfully, Philadelphia was not a city that had as much to worry about as groups like Chicago, Baltimore, and D.C. But yeah, Philadelphia was one of the cities we saw where murder is projected to rise this year at around 6%. So it's one of several cities that are seeing crime increase. But interestingly, in our analysis, the increase in Philadelphia was almost consistent with its normal year-to-year variation. We saw an increase of about 2 points net between 2014 and 2016. I'm sorry, I might be reading that wrong off of our chart, but that's about the same as the change in previous years as well.
I was just wondering if you saw it going down anywhere in the near future.
I would certainly hope so.
All right. Let's, before we get to the telephone calls, because we have a good number of them, John, you had said that there were some other reasons that we haven't gotten to about the rise in violent crime in certain areas. Could you just kind of tick those off for us, please?
Sure. And I think it's worth saying, because I think one of the reactions, and it's a narrative that's come up in the presidential campaign, is what is the role of law and order in maintaining a civil society and having less violence? And one thing I would point out is that over the last 8 years since the Great Recession started, we've seen dramatic cuts in local and county public budgets. If you look at the number of people employed by governments and the growth in that sector has been pretty much zero at a time when the private sector economic expansion has been huge. And what that means in this specific area is that law enforcement has fewer resources to tap into. It has less support directly within the agencies. It has less support in public welfare and social service agencies that help work with people with substance abuse problems, mental health problems, people who are looking for work, people who have issues with their family, people returning from prison and don't have the skills to enter the labor market. All of those services are cut relative to 7 or 8 years ago. And long term, you look at Philadelphia, you look at the tremendous damage that's been done to the city school system's budget over the last few years.
Sure.
And we are seeing the repercussions of that in the amount of violence that's happening, because the kids that were in those schools 5 and 6 years ago are now 18, 19, and 20 and on the streets and unprepared.
Okay. Let's get to politics for just a moment, since you brought up law and order. Of course, that's Donald Trump's position. Crime is increasing. He would be the law and order president if elected. Do you think, John Roman, that a Donald Trump presidency would reduce the overall crime rate?
Well, the first thing, just to be fair, Bill Clinton was the one who signed the Crime Act in 1994 that led to a lot of the increase in incarceration in this country. So they're both law and order candidates to some extent. I think that's fair to say. I think what we've seen in the last generation, last 25 years, is a real substantial increase in the use of non-law enforcement tools to reduce the level of crime and offending in America. We have all sorts of alternatives to incarceration now, where we treat underlying problems that lead people to crime. Again, mental health and drug abuse lead that list, but there's a whole host of other things that we try and do. We try and have police be community-oriented, problem-solving rather than just taking 911 calls and becoming members of those communities. And law and order, to me, seems to want to reverse all of the things that we've done to cut the murder rate in half, and that seems self-defeating.
All right. And Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, wants to continue the effort to end mass incarceration, tackle crime from the ground up, invest in education and job training, focus resources away from, well, actually increase substance abuse treatment, that sort of thing. Ames, feel free to weigh in here. Ames Gwarwart.
Sure. Actually, I agree with a lot of what Mr. Roman said. I think it's when I hear phrases like tough on crime, I want to hear what that means.
Yeah.
If it means increasing our reliance on mandatory minimums, then we have some questions about that. If you ask some police officers, even, we work with a group called Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. They will tell you that prison is at times an ineffective way to deter crime. And some people would actually be better served by diversion to mental health options, for example. So when I hear tough on crime, I just want to make sure that that also means smart on crime and using solutions other than incarceration, which have been proven to decrease recidivism and help people become productive members of society.
Mm-hmm. Well, increasing access to substance abuse treatment, improving education. This is the long haul approach, isn't it, John Roman?
Right. And that's something. So we're in Philadelphia. So Philadelphia was one of the early adopters of something called Drug Court, where we take drug involved offenders and try and help them get into recovery so they don't commit crimes. I think one important people might say, oh, that's soft on crime. That's hug a thug. You know, that's not going to solve our problems. The thing to know is that people who commit violent crimes aren't specialists. They're not gunmen per se. They are people who turn to guns in difficult situations, but they also might be somebody who shoplifts to support a drug habit. So helping them solve the underlying reason why they're putting themselves in situations where this can happen is really important.
All right. Getting to those calls as promised. David in Flemington, you're live on Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary, for taking my call. I grew up in North St. Louis, and whenever I compare all that I've seen living out on the East Coast for so long to places like North St. Louis or South Chicago, I realize that until you can change these patterns of having large defined areas of poverty and have more of broken up areas like New York is, you might have a few streets that are down on their luck, but then things change and the next one over doesn't. The East Coast doesn't have the luxury of geography that the Midwest does. You couldn't have an area as big as North St. Louis in New York and not have residential pressure on it. So in a sense, I'm hopeless that it could ever change unless you can change the geography and intersperse areas like North St. Louis and South Chicago with the more successful neighborhoods like New York does.
Thanks, David. We appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thoughts, John?
I think that's exactly right, actually. I think that that if you were to compare a map of where poverty exists within New York and city and you compared it to a map of Chicago, you'd be really struck by how much variation there is. Sorry, about how people of different races and economic conditions are living in proximity in New York and how segregated Chicago is. I am much more optimistic, I think, than the caller that we can solve some of the problems facing this country despite that limitation.
Why are you optimistic, John Roman?
Because I think we've been really successful the last 25 years, and I don't want us to get off track on that sense. And it's in all kinds of different domains beyond crime. I mean, in terms of, you know, technological improvements, environmental improvements, I mean, there's a long way to go on a whole plethora of issues, how we educate our kids, how we train people to be prepared for the job market. But if you compare society today to where it was in 1990, opportunities abound in ways they didn't a generation ago. It's just a matter of really focusing on the places that are have the hardest problems to solve. And that's what we haven't done.
All right. Young Poet tweets, why are people worried about violence? Because, and this is all in caps, the media shoves it in their face. Ames Grauert, what do you think?
I think that's part of the explanation for why you see such a gap between perception and reality on crime. If you turn on the 6 o'clock news, you won't see news about how Williamsburg in Brooklyn is so gentrified and become such a much safer area than it was decades ago. But you will hear about the most recent assaults, the most recent murders, and other disadvantaged areas of the cities. So the media can present a selection bias issue where you're confronted with the stories that are most likely to make you worry about crime. So I think that's a valid point in some way, but this program is doing a good service as a counterbalance.
Oh, well, thank you. All right, let's get back to the calls. Lynn is in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times, Lynn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of things to say. First, I think that people in America should start talking about and learning about Sir Robert Peel's 9 principles of policing. I think that if we did that in a national way, not just state by state, where the community is policed by the community. So the police are literally community members, and they put the community members first.
You know, hey, Lynn, let me just jump in for 1 second because we are up against the clock. How about we take Robert Peel's principle of policing, mm-hmm. and John Roman, you look like, are you familiar with that?
A little bit, enough to be dangerous.
Okay.
So let me just say this. I mean, I think that the idea has some merit in the following way. And we're doing this in Philadelphia, and I think Chris referenced this as well, the idea that we want to prevent retaliation. And one of the great ways to prevent retaliation is to engage the community, the family, the friends of somebody who's involved in a shooting, and try and get them to work with these community-based organizations that are not law enforcement, like Ceasefire and Cure Violence, and to get them to help to de-escalate the situation before the retaliation happens, and then the next retaliation happens, and then shootings spiral out of control. And that really is a community-based rather than law enforcement program, and it's been effective all over the country.
All right. We appreciate the call to Radio Times, Lynn. Chris Palmer had mentioned earlier in the show, I believe, that the figure was, what, 350? The Philadelphia Police Department is trying to fill vacancies.
So the number, I think, is very interesting. So I think the Philadelphia Police Department is down about 6%. Every police commissioner in every geography around the country will tell you they have an upper bound on the number of police officers they'd like to have, and they're almost all below that. And so that's different from having unfilled slots.
All right. And let's try to get an email in from Andy in Lansdowne. Is it too early to say that an 8% rise in the murder rate is a statistically significant number so that it represents a trend? Have we seen similar fluctuations in the murder rate that did not represent a change over the long term? Ames Gwarwert, you want to tackle that one?
Yes, absolutely. I'm happy to speak to that. If you look at the way murder rates have changed over the past couple decades, you'll see that there have been times where murder has gone up by a non-trivial amount, and any increase in violence is concerning, of course. In the very early 2000s, in 2005 to 2007, murder looked like it was reverting to an upward trend, but the trend very shortly thereafter broke and returned to a downward trajectory. Here at the Brennan Center, we work with an economist and a researcher, and they both like to chasten me about my use of the term trend. Mm-hmm. They like to speak in terms of three-year moving averages, and we don't have 3 years of data showing an increase in murders, and I hope we won't get there. So it's not too early to worry. It's not too early to ask questions about what's happening in these cities and how police can address problems there. It might be too early to call it a trend.
All right. And then we also have an email from a listener in Stone Harbor who asks, any data on how these issues are affecting future police prospects? Are people still interested in pursuing this as a career? Do you have data like that at your fingertips, Ames?
I actually don't, but I'm sorry to say, but a couple points have been made here, some by Mr. Roman. We know that good policing works, and there are a lot of police departments across the country, as he's pointed out, where they have fewer police officers than they would prefer to. Chicago has lost something like 300 detectives in the past couple of years. If we're looking at cities that have constrained budgets, they can't hire the police officers they want, then that might be something to be concerned about.
I mean, I think law enforcement is a great professional opportunity to pursue because the levels of the number of law enforcement officers in this country have remained relatively stable for 25 years, and there's every reason to think that they will. But I continue that way. But I really do think that it's the ancillary stuff. It's the people, and Chris talked about this as well, it's the people who are helping them map where the crime is, to find hot places and hot times and hot people, people who are at greatest risk of being a victim or being an offender, and we need people behind the scenes doing that work, and that's where the budget cut really, really hurts law enforcement.
All right. I'm going to read Ed's comment as opposed to go live to the telephone call. Ed, sorry about that because we're running short of time. Give free tuition to policemen to go to college. Might that encourage people to go into the profession? John Roman?
I think it's a terrific idea. I mean, we certainly do that with veterans, and it's been very successful in helping people transition back, especially with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. I think that a lot of urban big city law enforcement agencies already have policies that require their officers to be college educated, but the local law enforcement and the suburban law enforcement agencies that are the ones seeing these Ferguson-type effects could really benefit from this policy.
All right. John Roman, senior fellow at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
for Radio
you.
Times. And our thanks to you as well, Ames Gwarwert. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate your time.
Ames is counsel with the Brennan Center's Justice Program and lead author of the report called Crime in 2016, A Preliminary Analysis. And as always, we invite you to take a look at our Facebook page and listen to our podcast. To get there, head to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us.